Thanks so much for joining us on this Memorial Day. Larry Mueller here, and we are taking a look at the world of birds and birding with our guest, Bill Volkert. Bill's a retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, written a number of books, including A Journey of a Thousand Lifers, and he's led many, many bird-watching tours. So as we talk with him, maybe you want to know about those tours, or maybe you want to know about birds that you look forward to seeing this time of the year. Maybe you've got a question about identifying a bird. Join the conversation. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email. Maybe a photo to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Hello to you and all your listeners.
How did the, did the unusually mild winter affect the migrations of bird back to and through Wisconsin?
Well, the mild winter, most of the birds were on the wintering ground, so they really didn't know what was going on here. But it was an early start to spring. And it was also a little unusual that we had a very early warm-up, and then we sort of stalled out and bumped around with the weather. And, of course, the birds move with the weather, and as we've talked about in the past, migration can begin February, early March already with the first Canada geese and red-winged blackbirds. And right now, the end of May is kind of wrapping it up when the last of the migrants are coming. So the different species are responding to food availability through that whole long stretch of several months. Well, it depends on what the weather's doing at that time. So early on with those early warm-up, we saw birds coming ahead of schedule. And then with that sort of on-off weather and not really good, strong warm fronts, in other words, a lack of southerly winds throughout quite a bit of late April and May, the birds seem to trickle through. And talking a little bit here and there with some of the bird watchers, they also noticed it was a difficult year for many of them, just sort of hunt and peck to try to find birds. And it seemed that they were sort of scattered around a little bit. For myself, I never had any one particular day with a huge concentration. The birds were just sort of moving through my neighborhood. And, for example, Wilson's warbler was a bird that I did not see right around my home. And yet during one of the field trips for the State Ornithological Society, they found along the Woodland Dunes area along Lake Michigan. They said it was this huge concentration. So they all seemed to pool there. And I think it was that sort of mixed bag of birds. So the weather was unusual, and so was the migration. And the problem with migration is that it's not really a good barometer of how birds are doing. It's just simply because they're passing through and it is hit and miss. It really doesn't give us an indication of bird numbers. We'll be doing our surveys of birds once they settle down for nesting, because we now have a stable population. The birds are settled in. They're going to be staying put for a while. And that gives us a chance to count them on the nesting grounds and to get an assessment. So breeding bird surveys and other kinds of monitoring will be going on during the summer season and tell us how the birds are doing from year to year.
Chris and Rudolph has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, right. Chris.
Good morning, gentlemen. I do have a question about feeding hummingbirds, which I have done for years. Mm-hmm. My first question is, I read recently that you do not have to boil the sugar water. Is that true now?
Well, I don't know about boiling it, enough to get it to dissolve. So just warm it up a little bit, stir it around. Once you no longer see that sugar pooled on the bottom of the kettle, you know it's pretty well in solution, so that's good enough. So I always mix up a big kettle full. I get a couple of jars so then I can get a couple of days' worth. I can refill them as the birds are hitting it. And right now, I do have hummingbirds hitting it, but the orioles by me are—they're really hitting it hard. Yeah, they're attacking it, and they're feasting on that. So about every other day, I've got to fill those. But and also the colored stuff that you find—that's a sales pitch. The hummingbirds are coming to the feeder not because it's colored water, so that's really not doing anything. It's just the kind of an additive to it. So just. Buy some cheap sugar. That's what we'll do, is just the white granular sugar and mix it with water and just enough to go into solution.
All right. Chris, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Number 800 642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We did see some bird species arriving pretty early. I mean, from the show and in my own experiences, sandhill cranes, for example.
Oh, yeah. They came very early this year. As I said earlier, those early migrants, sandhill cranes, Canada geese, the blackbirds, bluebirds, robins, they were ahead of schedule just because the weather certainly was. And then as we got into April, there were a couple of oddball sightings of birds that showed up two and a half weeks earlier than they should have. It was just a few individuals, but they were noteworthy that somebody was seeing something way out of schedule. Something just got going on that weather and ended up here in Wisconsin a little bit early. I actually had a whippoorwill that I flushed from near my house way back in April, which was ahead of schedule. A bird I don't see all that often, but it was on the ground, flushed it, walked over a little closer. It flew again. I didn't want to disturb it too much because it was a cool day, but I had my camera with me, and I was trying to find them blending in with those leaves. I just left them alone at that point. So, yeah, it was just a mixed bag. And, well, that's just what you get. Each year is different.
We have a bunch of bird songs that Lee's got queued up today. And one is the black-throated green warbler. You got that one up, Lee?
A little buzzy. Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z.
Yeah.
So that's our little mnemonic. That's a little phrase that we use to try to remember that pattern of it. So it has that little bit of a buzz to it, and most commonly described as Z-Z-Z-Z-Z. Now, there are variations. The birds will change that up a little bit. This is a bird that migrates through Wisconsin the last week of April and the first 2 weeks of May, usually. And we have them nesting in the northern half of the state, usually in mixed hardwood and pine forests. So a bird that, if you get into northern Wisconsin, Door County, central part of the state, you should hear them singing up there on the nesting ground throughout June. Even in the northern Kettle Moraine, we'll have one or two of them there because of the old pine plantations that were planted yeah. there. A couple of stragglers will hang around there as well.
And the population of those birds has gone up and down a little bit. I know there was something the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative said there was some bad weather during breeding season. It'll happen from mm-hmm. time to time, and that'll affect, obviously, the populations.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, the last 2 days have been very cool and very rainy, and I'm a little concerned. The adult birds will get by fine, but for early nesters, they're mostly insectivores, and insects yeah. are just not active when it is raining and cool. And so they may be a little stressed to find enough food to keep those young going as they're growing. One bird I'm thinking of is Eastern Phoebe. It's a flycatcher. Mm-hmm. It's also one of our earlier arrivals among the songbirds.
Yeah.
And so they're nesting a little sooner than others. As we said just a bit ago, a lot of them are just still arriving and getting on the nesting ground and looking for a mate. So they're just initiating nesting. But some of these earlier arriving songbirds are on the nest, have young. And it can be a little tough to find food in that kind of weather.
Back to the milder winter for a minute. Mm-hmm. Has that helped birds that live year-round in Wisconsin, do you think? Chickadees, cardinals?
Sure. The annual cycle is, right now we're actually at the lowest point of the annual cycle for birds and other wildlife. There has been those losses throughout the year, so now the surviving adults are coming back. They're getting ready for that nesting season. As we get into late summer and fall, we've got the greatest population of the year. They've raised all those young. There's all those hazards for birds, especially the long-distance migrants, just to make the journey from here all the way to Central and South America. It's yeah. a long way to go. Yeah. There's a lot of hazards along the way. And then hopefully find a secure place and survive and then come back again. So there's naturally going to be losses of individuals throughout that year, and now the chance to try to rebuild those numbers. And for a lot of our songbirds, average lifespan is less than 5 years.
Yeah.
So there's a fairly good turnover rate. And with that kind of natural loss, you want to hope that they're replacing those young fast enough to keep the population going.
Chad in Oregon. We'll go to you now. Hi, Chad.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Great. Appreciate
Doing
the call.
Well.
I got a question about identification. We were sitting in our patio the other day, and we heard a bird talking to another bird. They're male, female, and I've never heard that type of bird before, and it struck us to be like, well, what kind of bird is that? So I looked up, I saw it. It's got a really long beak, thicker than almost like a hummingbird beak, but the size of a...
Oh, we lost you.
Up.
Chad, are you there?
But it was...
Oh.
We lost you, Chad.
Yeah, yeah.
About the size
bit.
Of what?
About a crow. Well, the size of a crow.
Size of a crow.
Yeah, and it almost sounded like monkeys chirping or talking to each other. Brownish, longer legs too. And then when it took off, I didn't see the other bird, but it was a decent size.
So it was sort of a chatting, singing back and forth.
Yeah, it was a singing, chatting back and forth, but almost like I've never heard that type of, like, it just caught us by surprise in terms of. Most birds you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's
yeah.
what we never heard of.
Oh, a sort of a reddish-brown color?
Reddish-brown.
How about brown thrasher? A little smaller than a crow, but it is large for a songbird. It is one of the mimics, as we refer to them. The mockingbird is probably the best known, which is not that common in Wisconsin. But these are birds that they will actually throw in their repertoire the voices and songs of other birds. And the brown thrasher has a real habit of tends to repeat things twice.
Okay.
So he'll sing along a little chirp chirp tweet tweet this
yeah,
on back and forth.
Lee's got a brown thrasher.
Okay, let's see if we can find that. Yeah, listen to this.
Yeah. Sound?
Yeah. It was.
Something like that?
It had a longer, we just looked it up, it's got a longer beak than a brown thrasher. It was like a hummingbird, like long beak, but even
so
longer.
So some sort of...
Nothing striking me. Maybe another listener can help, or I'll roll it around in my head here for a little bit.
Like a shorebird or something?
Yeah, but they're not really singing a lot. They're,
no,
they're
they
just certainly vocalize, but they're not going to be that noisy. And also habitat's going to restrict where you find them.
Chad, stay listening, and we'll see if somebody else can come up with
something. Yeah, or something might hit me.
Yeah.
This is probably a good time to do so. If you're listening to birds, which right now as the vegetation is getting thick and they're settling into the nesting ground, they're going to get a little harder to see, but they'll be very vocal. You may want to download the Merlin app on your phone. It's put out by Cornell University, and it is a bird and song identification app. It is something where you can just simply hit bird ID or song ID, sound, you know, the sound ID is what it comes up as a tab, and just let it record, and it'll identify the bird for you. I will say that it is not 100% foolproof. We've been testing it a little bit informally, trying to see how accurate it is compared to the birds that we know. It'll get better, but it is surprisingly good. And what took me 25, 30 years to learn all these bird songs, you can just put it on your phone. And so, yeah, you can save yourself an awful lot of time. And I would highly recommend that to anybody who wants to just try to get familiar with bird songs and a good learning tool, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for that call.
Yeah, the Merlin app.
Larry's in southern Wisconsin. What's on your mind?
Hi. Last week I heard it was three, maybe four birds. They were flitting through the trees, and the sound was neener, 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 neener.
Somewhat nasal sound, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about nuthatch?
Yeah.
No, I've never heard a nuthatch sing like that.
Well, nuthatches usually will be doing just a real simple little call, a couple of notes throughout most of the year. But when they get into the nesting season, there is a song for it, and they become a little bit more vocal. And there's a little variety of sounds that you'll hear out of the nuthatch. And so when you're listening for bird songs, it is the quality of the voice is one. And that's sometimes a little bit of a problem is that people have a hard time imitating the bird's voice really well. to identify. And then also the rhythm, as we said, with the black-throated green, we remember with the mnemonic, you know, z, 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 z. So that's the pattern of it. And in a way, it's kind of like, to me, for learning foreign languages. If you're not familiar with the language at all, you don't even listen, it's just chatter. If you start to learn a little bit, you're picking up words, you're listening along a conversation, and eventually you may become fluent and get involved in a conversation. But that takes, obviously, years of practice. And so same thing with learning the bird sounds. Is it is a foreign language for us. And as I say, it's hard to pick up that quality of the voice or to imitate it. Kind of reminds me of, say, when you're listening to somebody on the telephone. I mean, you don't even have to see a face, and you know a voice of somebody familiar.
Yeah.
And that's the way I recognize birds, is it's that voice as well as that pattern.
Larry, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert, our guest today, taking a look at the world of birds and birding on the Ideas Network on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at birds and birding here in Wisconsin with our guest, Bill Volkert. Great to have you listening in. Question, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Peter in Stevens Point, we'll go to you. Hi, Peter.
Hey there, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
Yeah, about a month ago, I'm guessing, I was sitting on my front porch. I live back in the woods. And a cuckoo started going and went for a good 2 to 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
Just steady.
Oh, cuckoo, wonderful.
Cuckoo, cuckoo. Yeah, and I've lived here 30 years, and I can't remember ever seeing it before.
We have two species, the yellow-billed and black-billed cuckoo. They're fairly large-sized birds for songbirds. But they're very secretive. Yeah, and they're secretive. So really, we identify them by the calls more often than seeing them. I mean, a pretty good-sized bird, and when they get into the trees, they'll sit very still, and it can be hard to pick out.
I think we've got the black.
Yep. Black bill is going to be a little more simple like this, a little more rolling and complex song for the yellow-billed, but both of them are somewhat similar. And, yeah, a really good one to pick out by its voice. As I say, it's a tough bird to see.
The last one you did, I don't think was it, because it was more mellow.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So it was the yellow.
Yeah.
Probably. Well,
that's the call note of it rather than the song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there we go.
Yep.
Lee's on magic fingers are working today.
Thanks, Lee. Always interesting birds. A tough one to find, and I don't come across them every year. One of their favorite foods are the tent caterpillars.
Oh.
And they actually seem to sort of invade areas when we have tent caterpillar outbreaks, which is always a mystery to me. How do they know that one area is going to have or is experiencing high numbers? Somehow they seem to find them.
Peter, thanks again. Appreciate it. Let's go to Gary in Milwaukee next. Hi, Gary.
Well, hello. See, I heard Bill mention a whippoorwill before. I have a question about a nighthawk.
Mm-hmm.
I should say this is from a memory that's 50 years old because I haven't seen a nighthawk in years.
Yeah.
But it seems like I recall at the time we lived in the country, it was a very quiet space, but we had big lights over our porch. And when these nighthawks would fly over the porch, as they darted around, it seemed like I recall a sound that would kind of resemble a truck using its engine brake, that kind of a chattering sound.
Sort of a ripping sound. Yeah.
Yeah, like a ripping sound. Was that the result of them darting around and maybe their feathers were buzzing like that? Do I have this memory right?
Yes. And the vocalization is just a real simple single note that you hear out of them, but that's the ripping of the wind through the wings, and they do that as in courtship. So this is right around dusk. They'll be diving. Now, they're a ground nester for the most part, which can make them quite vulnerable to predators, but they really adapted well to flat rooftops many years ago. And so a long time ago, when a lot of our buildings had the flat rooftops with the gravel on top, that was very attractive. Uh-huh. And nighthawks used to be fairly common in our cities. It was the changes in construction. They found that the rubber roofing was a lot easier, cheaper to put in. The problem is if Nighthawk tried to nest on that, it would bake the eggs.
Yeah.
And I remember years ago, I'd go to downtown West Bend and Fond du Lac in early summer. They were just diving for the big moths and insects above the city lights. They've all but disappeared. And yeah, it's been changes in that kind of construction. We still see that as a migrant coming through Wisconsin. I only had one or two this spring. I've heard from somebody else that one afternoon along the lakeshore of Lake Michigan, there was a really nice movement of nighthawks. So they're still coming through the area. They're a late migrant, usually. That latter half of May is when they're coming through. But yeah, numbers have certainly declined from what they were, say, decades ago.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood, we'll go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I recently attended a bird banding event in Hudson, Wisconsin. It was wonderful. I've been birding all my life, and I have many, many, many birds that come to my feeder. Mm-hmm. But this was a unique opportunity to see and handle birds that do not come to the feeder, such as some nice variety of beautiful, brightly colored warblers.
Oh, good for you.
And the family who did this, they are very, very knowledgeable, and they were so kind. So a great big thank you to them if they're listening. And I would highly recommend this to anybody. If you get an opportunity to see bird banding, it's just so interesting, and they're gaining a lot of information from doing this.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I've actually been a federally licensed master bird bander for many years. I first got my permit in 1982.
Whoa.
So yeah, I've captured over 10,000 individual birds. And when I was at Horicon Marsh, we used to do this as part of the Spring Bird Festival, a public bird banding. It is a research tool and technique. And so there's a little bit of a caution there between how much we want to have the public observe when we're actually doing research to capture birds, mark them, get all the data that we need. We recently hosted a bird banding event for the Natural Resources Foundation at our house. And yeah, it's a unique opportunity to have the birds in the hand. And as she mentioned, birds that you may not normally see or only get a glimpse way up in the treetops, yeah, to have them up close and personal is pretty neat. In fact, for myself this spring, I had a female oriole, a catbird, and also an adult male rose-breasted grosbeak. The two, oriole and catbird, I captured. They had my band on them from last year. And the grosbeak, I saw him through my binoculars sitting in a tree near my house. He had a band on, and I can tell you, I put that on him. And so this is the kind of information we get, that these birds are not just migrating back close to where they were the previous year. They're going right back to the exact same place, and their navigation abilities are just astounding.
They are.
I had a female yellow warbler at Horicon Marsh. I captured her in spring, in May time, so she had just arrived, which is, of course, before the nesting season. They're just coming back, so she had to be at least 1 year old. I caught her at the exact same bush 9 years later.
Oh.
And this little bird that's barely 4 inches long was going from Horicon Marsh all the way to Central America, or perhaps even Northern South America, into Colombia and back again, doing a good 2,500 miles each way every year. She had 50,000 miles of travel on her and came back unerringly to that same bush year after year. And we only know that because we marked it. Every yellow warbler in the world looks the same. Here we gave it that special identification, and this is some of the insights that we're getting. And, of course, nowadays with new technology, we're able to mark birds in very unique ways to get data like never before, with geolocator tags, nano tags, and other types of things. And, of course, with who knows what's coming down the way for very lightweight electronics and technology that we can affix to these tiny birds, what we may yet be able to get for insights.
Yeah. Christina, thank you so much.
Yeah, amazing experience. I'm glad you had a chance to see that.
Jerry in Kokana, we'll go to you. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, I have an identification question and then the life cycle or how long a rough grouse lasts, but the bird that I'm looking for it's a hawk. It kind of has lighter white or charcoal tinged edges on it, and it flies almost like one of those turkey vultures. that glide very graceful, but lower to the ground usually. But I mean, still very high, but not like the other ones.
Sounds like Northern Harrier, or what's also been in the past called the Marsh Hawk. And they are usually over open fields and wet meadows or even cattail marshes. And this is a bird that it tends to fly with its wings held up a little bit like the turkey vulture. And they're coursing back and forth looking for small rodents in these grass areas. Now, this is a bird where the male and female look quite distinct. The male is very grayish with dark wingtips. They both have a white rump patch. So if you see them banking a little bit, above the tail, there's a large white patch. The female is brown, mottled brown. And also the young of the year will have that similar color with a mottled brown plumage. So, yeah, marsh hawk or northern harrier, the most common name. Fairly widespread in Wisconsin, but, again, using these open fields, wet meadows, and marshes, as the name would imply.
Thanks, Jerry. Appreciate it. Tracy in Milton, on to you now. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, good afternoon. So yesterday we had some big storms that came through the area, mm-hmm. and afterwards I was taking a walk through the yard, and I found a nest in the yard and three baby robins that had been tossed out.
Mm.
Now, I gathered them up, I put them in the nest,
yep.
and then I put the nest in the crook of a nearby tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm just curious, do they stand a chance at all? Will mother come back and find them and help them out, or what is their fate when they fall out of the nest after a large storm?
Oh, good question. First of all, it is a myth that if you touch a bird, that the adults are going to smell that or scent that and abandon them. Don't believe that, because actually birds have a fairly poor sense of smell overall. So handling the bird is not the problem. It is the nest location. If it's close enough and the young are chirping, there's a chance that the adults will home in on that. It's always a little bit of a guess there whether or not they're going to come back to those young or just start another nest. Now, the good news for robins is there's certainly a large population, and they have multiple broods throughout the year. And one of the reasons for that is because the grackles and blue jays will oftentimes get in the nest and take the eggs. So I think there's usually the young robins that put them in pretty vulnerable places. And these are nests that you oftentimes see raided. In fact, yesterday I saw the first robin eggshell laying on the ground. One of those birds got in there. But they're going to try again and again. So, whether or not the parents will come back, they'll certainly hear those young chirping. I think you did the right thing, gave the best chance, and leave it to nature, I guess.
Yeah. Tracy, good for you. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. We have open lines, get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Vivian in Green Bay called to ask about overpopulation of Canada geese. What can we be done about them?
Well, Canada geese are obviously very adaptable, and anywhere you've got short grass and water is going to be attracted to them. So city parks, golf courses, retention ponds, all of these are very attractive areas. And the fact is that we have changed the land in a way to suit ourselves and also made it fairly attractive to Canada geese. That's why there's so many geese. They've just simply have responded and adapted very well to the changes we've brought to the land. In fact, I commonly will remind people that when we talk about populations of birds that are increasing and at the same time talk about threatened and endangered populations, they're a result of the same thing. As people use land and as we change it, there's winners and losers. And the Canada geese are the generalists out there. They can adapt very well to these land use changes. And they certainly have exploded in their numbers and taken over a lot of the areas, which unfortunately, when you think of the parks and golf courses and places like this, they're nesting and raising their young and, of course, making a mess and coming into conflict with people during the summer recreation period, which is beginning right now. And that's where the big problem comes in. First of all, for people who live near water, one of the bigger problems that we create is that people like to mow right down to the water's edge. They lead their young to the water for safety. They feed in the uplands. Well, if you're going to mow and keep it nice and open, they have easy access to jump back onto the land and go back down. And so especially lakeshore owners who mow right up to the edge, they're just creating opportunities and wonder why they're in their backyard. Leave some streamside or shoreline vegetation there, a physical barrier. They don't like to take their young through that tall grass because that's where the predators lurk. The other problem we have for conflicts is, now these birds are protected under both state and federal law, and so anyone that wants to try to reduce populations or move the birds has to work with DNR or a licensed contractor, and there have been attempts to try to relocate or remove Canada geese during the summertime. The problem with some of this comes into is, of course, if you got too many geese and get rid of a few, that's the way to solve the problem. But it usually takes place within public view, and not everybody agrees with those kinds of programs. So it ends up becoming more of a social political problem than it is a wildlife management problem. People are going to agree of what we're going to do about too many geese in an area. That becomes the hard solution.
Just thinking about the lake home that I had, we had the tall grass and so forth. Mm-hmm. The neighbor was right next door, did not. And I woke up one morning and looked out on the lawn. I had no geese on my lawn, but he had about 20, 25 geese sitting on
his
lawn.
Sure, you're just inviting them. Exactly. And that's the problem. We want to make it attractive to ourselves. And then it's like, well, why are all these geese here? Well, you've also made it very attractive and very accessible for those birds.
Marilyn in Milton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if you could tell me why a robin is continually dive bombing my windows.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's one robin.
Yes.
I've put reflective strips up.
Okay.
And that helps that window, but the rest of the windows he has found. And it's been going on about 2 months.
Yeah, I refer to this as shadow boxing. Basically, he's seeing his reflection. These birds are territorial this time of year, and he wants to keep other robins out of his little region. Well, every time he comes to that window, he hears that competitor, and so he's chasing and flapping and tapping on the window, trying to drive him off. He turns around, it's like, okay, solve that problem, and as soon as he looks at that glass, there he is again. The most common birds to do this tend to be robins, goldfinches, and cardinals, some of the more common and brightly colored birds, and it is an individual problem. In other words, among the robins, you've got large population, but all of a sudden one bird will get a bad habit. And as you mentioned, yes, you can put some sort of strips or something out that moves in the wind. That's probably the best to try to break their habit. The problem is they'll just go around the corner and find the next window, and that's going to be difficult to solve. If you can try to break them the habit very early on, that's probably the best to do before they get obsessed with it. The problem is for a lot of us, if you've got a day job, well, you get up in the morning, the bird's tapping on the window, you chase him away a few times, then you leave for the whole day.
Yeah.
Well, he just gets this, it's kind of an OCD type habit for the bird. He's just over there obsessed with this competitor and just fighting it all day. And he's uselessly wasting the energy for something because he's not going away. The other thing we'll find is mirrors on cars, too.
Yeah.
That's another one where you're going to see the reflection. And again, it's an individual habit. Out of all the thousands of robins out there, there's one or two of them that start a habit like this, and it's a tough one to break, unfortunately.
Betsy in Dodgeville shared that her cabin in Iowa in 1990 was the last time there were both cicada and cuckoos on the property. The cuckoos were very, very happy.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what happens this year with the predicted big cicada outbreak for the states south and east of us.
Going on right now in the Lake Delton area.
Okay.
Chris and Rudolph wonders whether they can add frozen Bing cherries to sugar water for hummingbirds. As the cherries thaw, the color makes it easier to see if there's still liquid in the hummingbird feeder, but wanted to make sure they're not doing the hummingbirds harm.
Probably not. I would be concerned about pulp that might get plugged up into the feeder because that's kind of a narrow tube. You're going to be doing more for yourself to be able to monitor your feeder than for the birds. I don't think it's going to hurt. I don't see it really helping in any significant way either.
Mm-hmm. Barb in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I saw a pileated woodpecker here in Fond du Lac yesterday. I've lived here for 30 years, and it's the first one I've ever seen.
Nice.
Is that south for them?
Well, actually, the pileated woodpecker population seem to be slightly increasing, and this is responding to the maturing of our forests. In a lot of areas, we've got bigger trees within the forest, and of course, a big woodpecker needs big trees. And so they've been doing fairly well. I live in the northern Kettle Moraine, and I have over the years noticed more of them. And if you get successful nesting in an area, well, the young have got to start spreading out. And very likely, this is what you're seeing, is these young birds dispersing. And I've noticed this around the Horicon Marsh area, which is not good pileated woodpecker area because it's just tiny woodlots.
Yeah.
These are birds that get chased out of an area. They're young ones that are moving around looking for a new spot. And so they're sort of bouncing around trying to find some big woodlot somewhere for themselves as an unclaimed territory. So you probably have one of these floaters, a bird that's locally moving around trying to find a suitable home for himself. But yeah, it's not, say, an uncommon bird these days in Wisconsin. No. But they're also fairly solitary, and a big woodpecker the size of a crow, it's something that you just don't encounter all that often out there. They're just relatively secretive, and they tend to stick to the interior of those big forests.
Yeah.
But always a great sight.
Always a great sight. I was thinking about the pileated woodpecker family that I saw in Door County. It was really fun to see those young because the parents kind of hung near them. I think there were three.
Oh, wonderful.
Young. Peninsula, it was at Peninsula State Park. So lots of people got to see.
Oh, that's
birds.
Memorable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thanks, Barb. Linda in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Last week, I went outside my front door, and there was a bird on the porch that had maybe hit my window. I'm thinking that's probably what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, it was about the size of a robin. But it was, when I went up and looked closer, it was a very dark gray on top, white on the bottom. It had yellow eyes, a yellow bill. It was long and slender. It looked a lot like the size of a catbird.
Mm-hmm.
But it had a really distinctive underside of the tail that had white and black striping on it. It was like a two-segment tail. When I looked it up, it matched the description of a northern mockingbird.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that, according to the map, it shouldn't be here.
Yeah. We're on that far northern edge of the range for northern mockingbird. So it is not a regularly occurring bird in Wisconsin. With the warmer weather, we expect that they'll probably start moving north and become a little bit more established here. But every year, we do get sightings of mockingbirds in Wisconsin. So, yeah, you look at your reference, it'll say they shouldn't be living here. It doesn't mean that we never see them. It's just that we're not in the heart of the range where we'd expect them every year across a large part of the state. But, no, we've had mockingbirds sighted every single year somewhere in Wisconsin. We have a few nest records of mockingbirds. But, as I say, they're a little thin here because we're just at the far northern edge of their normal range.
Linda, thank you.
Exciting.
Yeah, exciting. Thank you, Linda. Appreciate the call. Bill Volkert, our guest today. Questions for him about birds and bird migration? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News. The Sandhill Crane to get us started on this segment of the show. Thanks, Lee, for cranking that one up. Always nice to have that. And we will go to some other calls too. I'm not sure we're hearing.
Oh, there we are.
Now we are.
Okay.
I
was going to mention on the Sandhill Crane, a very early migrant, as we've talked earlier in the program, birds that were very vocal during the early part of the nesting season. Right now, they're getting quiet.
Yeah.
They're raising their young. The young are out. They've been hatched out a couple of weeks ago already.
Yeah.
And so the adults are going to be very silent. Now, this is a bird that takes a good 4 or 5 years before it to mature and start to nest as an adult pair. So we're going to start seeing the young birds moving around, and they'll start forming flocks. And those birds may make a little bit more noise. But the adults and young, they're totally silent. We'll see the same thing with Canada geese, by the way. The younger owls, they're already about 2-3 weeks old. Some of them are a full month old in southern Wisconsin. The adults are going to be totally silent at this time because they don't want to attract the attention to the young, which are very vulnerable. But we also have the non-breeding birds, and they're going to start forming flocks, and then they'll be heading north to molt their feathers. These will be the molt migrants, and we'll start seeing movement here within the next few weeks. Those are the geese that you will hear honking. These are the non-breeding birds, and also the failed breeders, adults that may have nested and had a nest that was lost. They're not going to try again for the year, so they'll join those flocks, and they're going to fly to northern Wisconsin, some of them north of Lake Superior, some of them well into Canada, just to shed their feathers.
Hmm. Thinking about sandhill cranes, we were on a golf course a couple of weeks ago, and there was a mom and a baby sandhill.
Oh,
and
nice.
Just stopped to take a photo of it, and and then suddenly swooping in, I think it was dad, flapping his wings and making himself look really big.
Yeah, trying to keep you at bay.
Well, we weren't that close, and it was sort of a chance thing, but it was kind of interesting to see that.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And they're not going to take a chance because they know those young are extremely vulnerable because they have no other way to escape. So, yeah, they're going to make quite a show.
Yeah.
Oh, good for you.
Helen in White Lake, we'll go to you. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Joe. I have a question about a red cardinal that goes to our side view mirrors on both of our vehicles.
Oh,
and
yes.
He's just looking at himself, and I wonder why he's doing that.
We had talked about this just a little bit ago about a very similar experience.
A person
who had a robin on the window, they're seeing the reflection. They think it's another competitor. And a problem with the mirror, of course, they're also going to leave their droppings on the side of your car and on the mirror itself. I remember years ago I had one bird that was doing it. It was a cardinal, and I had to take plastic bags and put them over the mirrors just to obscure the view. The problem was that I'd find myself driving down the road and realize I can't see out of my mirrors yet. I'd have to pull over, take off the bags. It solved the problem. It just created a little extra work for myself.
Helen, thank you for calling.
Thanks.
Oh, my gosh. Susan emailed a photo of a limpkin in northern Vilas County. Hoping it comes back. It was from last year. She's hoping it comes back this year. The limpkin, she had a really nice photo of it.
Very unusual bird. It's in its own family. Its voice sounds a little crane-like. Tall bird, very speckled brown with sort of white spots all across the body with a long downward curved bill like an ibis. They're found across the southern United States, very common, say, Florida to Texas. They're also found throughout Central and South America in wetlands all the way down to Argentina. We are well out of their range, but within the last few years, we've had sightings of limpkins. The population has been moving out of those areas from the south. They've been finding their snails as their main food. And some of the exotic snails that have been introduced into our lakes are a food source for them. They seem to know that. And these birds have shown up in Wisconsin several times in the last 3 years. So a bird that we never knew of in Wisconsin, we've now had a couple of sightings, most likely non-breeders, young birds that are dispersing, moving around, and just showing up way out of the normal range because they're not migratory. They'll just hang around year-round in those southern wetlands. And for some reason, there's some little change in their behavior and habits, and is a bird that has been...
In a big wind.
Yeah, exactly. You get caught on that, and here they are in Wisconsin periodically.
Mary in Sugar Island, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, the day they did that bird count, I counted 49 birds in my yard and around. But anyway, the one that was my surprise this spring was the kingbird.
Oh, very nice.
He was right on the deck railing, and he came. I had some suet on the deck railing, and he seemed to like that. So then, and I think my orioles and the grosbeaks and the redhead woodpeckers have all been here before.
Oh, that's a nice sighting.
I was down by the basement looking out the window, and this redheaded woodpecker flew right to the sunflower feeder.
Well, you've got some colorful birds in your backyard. The kingbird is another bird that's in the flycatcher family. It's actually a very long-distance migrant. They'll go all the way to the northern part of South America. And these are birds that are usually more open fields and wide-open types of landscapes and commonly will nest in small trees near water. So it's not a real common bird in any one location, but it is fairly widespread throughout Wisconsin. Always a great sight. Very dark grayish black on the back, white belly, and a very distinctive white stripe across the whole terminal end, the far end of the tail. And those are the best identifying marks of it.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. Another caller, and this goes back to the person we couldn't quite figure out the the long-legged bird with a fairly long bill. And the caller suggested it might have been a woodcock. And that's not a bad guess, I don't think.
That is a shorebird. He was talking about being very vocal. Usually it's just that nasal peent is the only call. And so the description sounded a little bit, as you mentioned earlier, shorebird, but they usually don't have a very complex vocabulary and types of a vocal repertoire. So he was talking about the listening to the bird, but that is a possibility, is the American woodcock.
Jake emailed to say that they ran out of grape jelly for their Oriole feeder, so they tried raspberry jam instead. And Jake said that the Orioles didn't touch the jam. They concluded the Orioles prefer grape jelly over oranges.
And it seems to be the jelly of choice for Orioles. And it also seems that here's a little bit of individual taste, because some people can't even keep up with the jelly, where others, I've heard them put it out and the birds hardly touch it. And you'll find this among some of these birds where they're looking for something sweet. My Orioles, I mentioned earlier, they're going after the hummingbird feeder. I've tried oranges in the past. I tried a little jelly that didn't seem to be the most attractive. They seem to have a little different taste. This year, I've got a catbird that I cannot keep off the suet feeder. He's just pounding that. I've had him on in the past where they've nibbled a bit on it, but this guy's on it several times a day. And you will get these individual habits of birds, something that's just a little bit out of the ordinary in terms of its dietary preferences.
My Oriole feeder, I've got little places where you can place orange halves.
Oh, yes.
And then the jam goes in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take both of them.
Oh, good. I've tried oranges, and the ants were on it more than the birds were.
Well, yeah.
So, again, try it a little bit and offer the very variety of food and see what the birds are attracted to. It's the best way to do it.
Jack called to say they're seeing swans for the first time on the lake by their cabin in Vilas County. A couple of swans were either mating or fighting.
Well, we have got two primary species of swans in Wisconsin, the tundra swan, which in the past, many years ago, was called whistling swan in the old books, and the trumpeter swan. Whistling swans, the tundra swans, they passed through Wisconsin some time ago. We usually see them in late March, early April, and they're heading way up into Canada and as far as Alaska for the migration. So those birds have long passed through Wisconsin, but we have introduced the trumpeter swan. And these were birds that were introduced originally in the northwestern part of Wisconsin. They were established well throughout the northern half, and the population continues to increase. And so, yeah, you might have a new pair that's showing up on the lake.
Mike in Algoma, hello.
Hey, good morning. Talking about migration.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been fascinated with the idea that birds are up in Alaska, and then they fly south to South America. The concern is, how did they ever develop that type of a migratory pattern?
Mm-hmm.
20,000 years ago, we had a glacier, which surely didn't provide for any type of habitat for them to live up north.
Right.
So did those birds come from down south and move their way up north, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, good question. Well, you know, even when we were in the Ice Age, they just covered that northern portion of North America. So you still had birds that were going, say, from Central, Northern, South America up near the ice front, so into the southern and Midwestern states. So it was a much shorter trip for them. As the ice had retreated, they just expanded that. And the main reason for the migration is the fact that here we've got all this land mass, and we got a lot of good habitat, but all this food is only seasonally available. So the birds have...
They
got to
fly.
They've been able to adapt to that, to come up here, take advantage of all of this, and then retreat as the winter weather moves in.
Bill Volkert, our guest. Great to have Bill with us, a birder and naturalist extraordinaire. Nice to have him with us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at birds and birding on the program right now with our guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Always great to have Bill stop by. And certainly if you have questions, you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Bill in Oregon has a question for you. Bill, let's...
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
About a month ago, my wife and I were coming back from birding up north, and we decided to stop at Horicon Marsh and did a little driving tour area, and were amazed to run into something that, according to our 1980s Peterson guide, said that should be anywhere around here. And little research is telling us that black-necked stilts have been seen at Horicon since the late 80s, early 90s?
Early 90s.
Okay. Yeah. Can you go into the history of that a little bit?
Yeah, it was a very odd one. If you look at black-necked stilts, the real nesting range is out in Colorado in the western states and winter down in Central America. We are basically 1,000 miles out of the range, and birds will be picked up in the wind. They'll get off course. It's not unusual. This is what makes it interesting for bird watchers, is to see the unusual things that may show up, just like we talked earlier about the limpkins. Usually these birds realize that they're far from where they should be, and they'll pick up and leave and be just a short-time visitor. For some reason, black-necked stilts showed up at Horicon Marsh. It was more than one. They found mates, found a suitable habitat, and started nesting there. And the population actually became firmly established and has been growing, and are actually now nesting pairs showing up in other small wetlands south of Horicon. So it was a really unusual pioneering species, and a friend of mine has been doing surveys out there to take a look at the populations, and we've had 30, 40 pair of them on Horicon Marsh in the last couple of years, so they have really increased. And I mentioned this to some of the bird watchers a number of years ago. We also had at Horicon one year a bufflehead, one of our small ducks, which should be nesting up in Canada. They actually nested in a wood duck box in Wisconsin and came back again the next year.
Hmm.
So here they came, just like the black-necked stilts, but they never successfully raised young and established. Well, they did raise young, but they never established a tradition. They were a one-time nesting thing. Hmm. They gave it a try, and they disappeared. And this is sort of that make it or break it of a pioneering species. They come into an area out of their normal range. They'll find it suitable. They'll try to raise a family. But do they actually establish a population? It doesn't happen very often, but black-necked stilts certainly did. And, very unusual occurrence that we now have a permanent population way far removed from the heart of the normal range.
You mentioned observations and so forth, and you've got a little study that's going to be coming up to try and identify birds and bird species. Bill, thanks again, by the way.
Yes, in the Northern Kettle Moraine, it is one of our important bird areas, and it's actually been identified as one of the top 10 for conservation efforts. And so one of the projects that I'm undertaking with a couple of good friends of mine is we're going to try to establish a series of transects to get an assessment of the distribution and numbers of nesting birds in the state forest. It may take us more than one year to get really sound coverage of it. We're looking for volunteers, but I will say we need volunteers with really good experience with bird identification, because most of it's going to be done by ear. And so we're looking for people who are going to be walking sections of the forest, usually at least a one-mile stretch with every couple hundred yards, stop, listen for 10 minutes, and identify all the birds within that area, because we want to get a real refined look at who's nesting and relying on it, and establish a protocol as a baseline so that, say, maybe 5 or 10 years from now, it could be repeated to see if there's some degree of changes among different birds. The problem is that myself and my good friend Jeff Bauman, we've both been birding there since the 1980s. I started a little before him even. anecdotally, we can both tell you about certain birds that are just not as common in the area as we used to see them. We just don't have good data what degree of decline has there been, or even birds that may be increasing, what might be becoming more common. So we're trying to get a little bit of a better assessment on that. The Breeding Bird Atlas at least gave us some identification of birds that did nest there and throughout Wisconsin, but it did not give us really good hard numbers of the densities of these populations.
Yeah. Tim and Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Larry, thanks very much. I really enjoy Bill every time that he's on. And
I
joined a little
that.
Bit late today, but my question is this, that we have land over in Crawford County, and we see more and more red-headed woodpeckers. I mean, they're really a gorgeous bird, and I'm sort of wondering why, and they make a racket, and I'm wondering if it has anything to do maybe with, you know, emerald ash borer and ash trees dying, and have they moved in more, or are you seeing anything like that in the rest of the state?
Good question. I really think that some of the smaller woodpeckers, downy, hairy, maybe red-bellied, have certainly responded to the available food from emerald ash borer. I've got a lot of woodpeckers around my area, my neighborhood, and that probably is a readily available food source. Pileated woodpecker, it's going to be more the maturing of the forests for them. That's too small of a food source. And, it possible that is a food source for the red-headed. Now, for most of Wisconsin, it is not a common bird, and certainly not as common as it was, say, decades ago. But that southwestern part of the state, they seem to be hanging on quite well and maybe even increasing. I know the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge has done quite a good job of savanna restoration, and that is really what they're looking for. It is not a bird of the deep forest, so widely scattered trees is really more their preferred habitat. And, of course, they need to have the secure nesting and also some food. And, yeah, it is possible that the ash borer is one likely food source for them. But, yeah, it's good to see that there's at least one area of a stronghold of the redhead woodpecker in Wisconsin yet.
Yeah. Tim, thank you very much for calling. Tim Isley.
Oh, very nice. Oh.
Is that great. Great wildlife writer and somebody who appears on the show himself.
Yeah,
from
a good
time
friend
to
of
time.
Ours. Oh, great.
Wade in Trempealeau, it's on to you. Hi, Wade.
Hello. Nice program. I'm calling because I'm just curious about if the general population of birds is holding steady or decreasing. It just seems to me that the morning chorus of the spring birds is less than it used to be. I don't think I'm hearing as many birds as I used to. Are the numbers holding up?
That's a good question. Yeah, you know, the morning chorus is really that right around sunrise when everything starts vocalizing. And
really fun to be out there at
that
time.
If you can make the effort, get yourself out of bed early, get out there just before sunrise and that first half hour or so after sunrise, everybody's tuning up. The forest comes alive. It really is the music of nature, and certainly that spring and early summertime. It's beautiful to listen to. It is a little bit more silent than it was years ago. There was a report back about 4 or 5 years ago of the decline of songbirds, something like 3.5 billion birds that we estimate have been lost over the last 25, 30 years, according to a kind of accumulated data from 7 different kinds of bird survey and bird information that we have, trying to get estimates of the continental bird population. And the problem is that we've got things like red-winged blackbirds, gulls, Canada geese that are extremely abundant and even increasing. So if we're talking about 3 billion birds being lost, it is certain species that have seen tremendous declines, especially among the grassland birds and some of our other forest songbirds. Some have been hit quite hard. Certainly among songbirds, we know there just isn't that insect food out there that there used to be either. Just drive around in the summertime and see what is not hitting your windshield compared to, say, many years back. There just is not that density of food out there, for one, and, of course, other land use changes. And it's not just, say, land use changes in Wisconsin, but these birds are migrating all the way down to southern United States and the tropics. So it's all that stopover habitat in between to make that journey successfully and then to survive through the winter period. So, yeah, humans are having an impact, and it is really a multiple-pronged impact, too. We can't, say, put our finger on it as one single cause. It's a lot of the different things we're doing that are having an impact. And I think as people become more aware of birds and wildlife and natural areas, and each of us tries to do something to help that, we can stave that off. We may never return to the numbers of birds that we used to have, certainly enough, say, 50 or 100 years ago, but we can keep them from disappearing. That'd be the most important thing. And I think each of us can do a little something to help those birds.
Yeah, well, you know, advice on that?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I would start out with is start with your backyard. First of all, just put out a bird feeder and a bird bath just so you can enjoy birds and even know they're there and share it with your family and just to see birds and have them become part of your life. Offer a variety of foods, which will bring in a variety of birds, the black oil, sunflower seeds, suet, niger, hummingbird, and oriole feeders. All of those can be attracted to birds. Not everybody's going to attract the bigger, same array of birds, depending on the neighborhood and habitat you have. The other thing I would also do is plant some native plants. A lot of us mow those far corners of our yard, and that's the only time we visit it is when we're out there chopping it down. Try to get some native plants, some shrubs, some wildflowers, something that's going to be food and shelter for birds. The Wisconsin Bird Conservation Partnership has a new campaign called Save Our Songbirds. This is their SOS campaign. And they're focusing on three main things, which is adding native plants to your landscape, preventing window collisions, and they're focusing also on helping migratory birds by choosing bird-friendly certified coffee. This is where they've overwinter in the tropics. The sun-grown coffee is basically a biological desert. It has as much available for habitat for birds as a cornfield. Shade-grown coffee is extremely rich, so if you enjoy coffee, try that. And I would really emphasize the window collision prevention. A woman called in earlier about the mockingbird that hit her window. It may only be 3, 4, 5 birds a year at your home, but count up the number of homes you're in neighborhood. And all of a sudden, we're into hundreds of birds that are dying because glass is just completely unnatural. I did this on my home. I would have a bird about once a month hit a window, and it was just terrible to listen to that thud out there.
Yeah.
And by simply applying something that makes them more visible, and I would suggest going to the American Bird Conservancy website. They've got a lot of good information on preventing window collisions. There's a lot of great materials out there to make those windows a little more visible. And it's not going to make it that much more difficult for us to enjoy the view outside. And I think it's just great that you can look at your feeders, see the birds, and know that you don't have this mortality factor right there for them slamming into your window and breaking their necks. Or sometimes they do fly off, but we don't know what sort of internal injuries they may suffer and may not survive from that collision either. So, yeah, try to do something to help them.
John emailed to say they've been seeing, you mentioned bird baths, they've been seeing small birds, maybe red-eyed vireos, attack the bird baths to get a drink of water rather than perch or bathe. Is this common?
I wouldn't say it's common, but I think it's just in the same way that we talked about earlier with birds' food preference, where there's general food that a lot of birds are going to come to eat, and then all of a sudden there's an individual that just happens to have a particular habit. And I guess in the same way, when we talk about birds that are shadow boxing on mirrors or in glass, it's not that common, but somebody gets a bad habit out there or an unusual habit. And so I think this is what's fascinating is that we can learn a lot about birds and other wildlife and their general habits, and there's always those exceptions.
Well, we've got a photo that you had a chance to see earlier from Chad. He wanted that bird identified.
Easy to do. It's a green heron. It's the smallest of our herons. He's about the size of a crow. It's not an uncommon bird, but they'll nest in trees, so they're pretty well hidden up there, and then they're lurking along the shorelines of ponds and streams where they're looking for small fish and frogs. They're commonly flying, say, from a roost site or nesting site to an area where they're going to be hunting for food. And this is what, you know, like anybody who's out fishing, they like to have it kind of quiet and private. So you may not find them commonly along a lakeshore, or they'll quickly flush. I usually see them when they're coming and going. And it's a bird, I think, that's easy to overlook because you may just simply glance and think it's a crow. It's about that size. But they tend to have a little bit more of an arched wing in the wing beat. this tucked neck and a pointed longer bill than a crow. And so take a close look when you're seeing these mid-sized birds flying over. A green heron is not an unusual one.
Denny emailed to say that Bird Note episodes are often repeated during PRX Remix on Saturday and Sunday nights. oh my gosh. Oh,
great.
You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You mentioned scarlet tanagers earlier. Mm-hmm. It's one of the many species that migrates at night. If you got Lee's, I think's got a scarlet tanager for us.
Listen to it like a robin with a sore throat. Robin-like but raspy.
Yeah.
And just sort of rolling back and forth. And it's a bird that by voice can easily be overlooked because we hear robins all the time. I had one, in fact, just the day before yesterday in my woods. And scarlet tanager is just brilliantly colored. I mean, that is just a fire engine red or orange color to it with the black on the wing. But he's also a treetop bird. And so now that the leaves are just fully formed and so dense, I mean, this is a bird I heard up there. I walked back and forth. I never got to look at it. It's a really striking, attractive bird, but it's typical of birds of, say, tropical origins. It can be brilliantly colored, but if you're in a rainforest, it's easy to hide and not make yourself too visible for predators. Same thing here. They're brightly colored so a female can see the male at close range. How does she find him up there? It's by voice. And so a scarlet tanager is not that uncommon in Wisconsin, but I would really recommend learn the song of it and go to some of these larger, mature forested areas and listen for them.
Kenneth in Beloit has a question. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I wonder about the state of meadowlarks in our state. Mm-hmm. I remember being awoken to the song of meadowlark.
Meadowlarks.
Yeah, they've certainly declined in numbers. And this is one of our grassland birds. They were very common in with the widespread prairies in early part of North America. And this has all been converted to a farmland. And they did adapt for quite a while to pasture land. But even that habit of pasturing cattle has changed. And changing from mixed grass crops to the early clover cutting. Right now is the time of year when some of the first hay cutting is taking place. And these birds have just settled in the nest. And so it's changes in land use that have certainly affected their population. They are not anywhere near as common as they used to be. And as I mentioned, you know, a lot of our grassland birds have seen very steep declines.
Let's listen to one.
Nice, clear, kind of rolling whistle.
Yeah, it's a pretty song.
Yeah, and not as common of a voice out there as it used to be.
I used to hear them all the time when I was a kid.
Yeah. So that's one of the losers out there in terms of its numbers and available habitat. And it's something that really requires large, open grassland areas.
Michael in Janesville, what's on your mind?
I was up near Mofton last week and spotted a bird I don't believe I've ever seen before, about the size of a robin or a bit larger, dark or black mostly, but very distinctly white on the back half of the underside of the wings in flight. And I can't get any good ID off of the internet or elsewhere. Wondering what that might have been.
First one that comes to my mind is towhee. Take a look at an eastern towhee. From your description, it's something I'm envisioning.
Yeah.
Also, rose-breasted grosbeak is very dark on the back with white under rump, right in the wings, white underbelly. But, of course, the male's got that real bright rosy red in the throat, which is pretty diagnostic. But towhee is one that would come to mind.
Yeah.
I'll check that out.
Yeah, there you go, Michael. Thank you. Valerie.
It's a possibility anyway.
Yeah, so. A possibility. Valerie in Escanaba, Michigan, your turn.
Hi. You listed many threats to birds, and one of them I don't think you mentioned is actually the first on the list that American Bird Conservancy recently published, and that is roaming cats outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
According to American Bird Conservancy, over 2 billion birds per year are killed by cats that are unleashed and outdoors.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize their cats are killing birds mm-hmm. because they don't see it happen, and they think it's only an occasional incident, but it actually is a very significant reason for our diminished bird population.
Well, you are correct, and the Canadian Wildlife Service actually identified it as, for Canada, the number one human-caused mortality for songbirds. Cats are predators, and they're also were never native to this continent, so we have an exotic predator. And between feral cats, those that are just roaming out there in the wild, and those that people allow outdoors, that's at least the one that we can control. And, just to think that your cat is innocently going out and maybe getting the occasional mouse. No, they do hunt, and they do have an impact. And, yeah, keeping cats indoors, that's really another thing that we can do. I know it's difficult for people who are pet owners to think of their pet as a killer, but, cats certainly are native-born, natural-born predators.
Yeah.
And birds is the main food. Yeah, appreciate it.
You got two cats, and they're both indoors, and they never get outdoors. Yeah. Bill, you got something else for us there.
Just a quick announcement I want to make. So, for the last 10 years, we've been leading tours, bird watching tours to Nicaragua, of somewhat unexplored and lesser known of the Central American countries. And we just started announcing our tour for 2025, February 16th through 27. It'll be a 10-day tour with 2 days of travel for people, and we'll show you some of the best bird watching sites in the country. You can find information on my website at billvolkert.com. And I also want to mention on another subject, a book that myself and my friend Kurt Sampson put out on the Indian Mounds of Horicon Marsh in the Upper Rock River. Fortunately, he's an expert archaeologist, so it's not my main field, but it was something I've always been interested in from the working at Horicon Marsh. And that's also on my website or at the Facebook page at the Effigy Mound Initiative if people are interested in Indian mounds of the Dodge County area.
Oh, yeah. And that, you know, we interviewed you about that, and it's a fantastic book.
Yeah, it's been as a subject of interest to me for a long time, but I needed the right person and an expert to really work on it. And fortunately, Kurt was just that person. And many, many years of work on it, but we finally got that out for those who are interested in that subject as well.
Well, in the last 30 seconds, I want to hear a rose-breasted grosbeak. Have we got one up there?
Another nice, clear whistler, but it's back and forth and back and forth. And this is something I think is, if you're going to start to listen to birds, you know, it's this common background music, and most of us just dismiss it. And oftentimes, until you point it out, people, you know, they hear it, they're listening to it, but they don't hear it, so to speak. It's just sounds in the background. Once you start to listen for it, there's a lot of birds that have these clear whistles, and they start to sound alike to us. Robins are very common. The oriole certainly whistles. We heard the slightly raspy whistling of the scarlet tanager, this little rolling back and forth of the rose-breasted grosbeak. We may think that they're very similar. A little bit more as you learn from it, you'll learn to distinguish those. And so, yeah, open your ears, open your eyes, get out there, enjoy it. It's a wonderful world of birds out there.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Thank you so much. Our guest, Bill Volkert, always a pleasure to have him with us. Coming up, we are going to take a look at purple martins. It's something we didn't get to. And we've got a new guest coming for you. Dick Nicolay will be with us to talk purple martins. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources lists the purple martin as a species of special concern. These swallows live together in large numbers, almost exclusively in human-built multiplex birdhouses, and we're going to talk about the need for people to maybe erect some of those birdhouses to help save the species. And our guest, Dick Nicolay, Dick's a retired biologist for the Wisconsin DNR and current Wisconsin Purple Martin Association board member. He estimates he's banded more than 25,000 birds, including 10,000 purple martins. So do you wonder what it's like to host a community of purple martins? Have you spent evening watching swallows swoop about as they feed on flying insects? Give us a call. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dick Nicolay, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
No problem on that, Larry.
It's great to have you with us. When did you first get interested in purple martins?
I got interested when I was 5 years old, and I'm 73, almost 73 now. So a long time.
Oh, and what got that interest going?
Well, my grandfather on his farm had a purple martin colony, and he perpetuated it as long as he owned the farm. So it just, the song of purple martins is indeed part of that. But the birds are very social. And once when they get to know you, it's kind of like I always tell people, it's part of your family. The birds recognize you. They kind of socialize with you to tell you, hey, it's a great day, in a sense, from bird talk. But it really does get down to that. When there's somebody new that comes to a colony, the birds react to that person in some way or another, but they don't react to you. And so they know that this new person may be an intruder and may be an enemy. Who knows?
I understand a year ago you were in Brazil and saw purple martins there. What did you learn on that trip about the lives of these migratory birds?
Well, it's a long ways to fly, I can tell you that. And if one wanted to travel 4,000 miles, it kind of wears you out. I can tell you that. Trip down there took about 30 some hours, and trip back took about 24 hours. And the species as a whole, before they come to North America, they concentrate on a very small little area on a tributary to the Amazon, north of a large city called Manaus. And the distance is maybe about 15 miles as the crow flies or as the purple martin flies. But they concentrate on this one island for roosting at the night. And this one island where they like to go constitutes about 1 acre in size. So roughly about a football field in size, you have, when I was there in March, about 160,000 purple martins came into this.
Wow.
And so North America's birds are very concentrated before they head northward. It takes about, they stay at the island approximately about 2 weeks, and then process what I call growth of their feathers before they can migrate. Their primaries are the last feathers to come in, three of their feathers. And that's really what takes about 2 weeks' time. They don't have a whole lot of, at that site, a whole lot of enemies. That's why it's a great roosting spot. The only predator I seen was a juvenile out there of a peregrine, and that was the only bird that bothered them. And so just picture 50 miles across flooded, and there are islands out there that
probably are very steep, and the water can be, it's flooding trees, so it's flooding them about 80 feet deep.
Wow. Wow. So when they're all concentrated like that, how do they eat? I mean, there can't be any food on that acre.
No, purple martins are aerial insectivores, and so they need flying insects to be able to survive. And so that also means that up here in North America, temperatures have to be approximately about 48 degrees before insects truly can fly out there. And so when you have cold days, there are no insects. And so using that logic, this whole area down there where they come to roost is fairly sterile. And for insects, now you go towards Manas and further to the east, to the west of that point, there are lots of insects. And so they can forage down in those areas. It doesn't take long to fly 20 miles. But the security at night is really the reason why they go there. And so they're very vulnerable because these trees, when I was there, only about 10 foot of the trees were above the water, and you could go in, actually canoe into the trees, and you could literally grab the birds out if you wanted to. That's what researchers do down there. They grab birds and put them in bird bags, and then they go back and then either band them or put transmitters on them or various other designations on the bird to be able to see them a lot easier when they come back to the North America.
Hmm. So where are they found? And certainly there we find them in Wisconsin, but basically where are they?
Well, there are actually three subpopulations of purple martins across the U.S. There is Subis, which is our eastern population. There is Hesperia, which is in the southwest or the desert southwest. And then there's Arbicola, which is in the northwest or basically along the coastline of the Pacific Ocean. In Wisconsin, much the same. We're kind of divided up into three areas where they're concentrated. What I call the West Central, around Eau Claire going up to Cumberland, is concentration of purple martins. You come over into the central portion of the state in Wood, Juneau County, there is concentrations of birds there. And then you end up with the southeast concentration of what most people are familiar with, going from Green Bay down to Milwaukee over to Madison. And that triangle is indeed a lot of wetlands, especially large lakes like Lake Winnebago. There are a lot of grassland opening areas out there. The birds don't like lots of trees, but they like lots of area that they can fly around.
So here we have birdhouses that apparently the purple martins have to rely on.
Correct. They at one time, purple martins used to nest in what we call secondary cavity sites. Woodpeckers excavated them, or snags rotted out and created openings in trees. Historically, some of these trees were what we call super canopy trees, like white pines or large oaks. That's where purple martins nested in savanna areas. That again is fairly open, but oak trees do not put out leaves very early. Usually, after most other trees are putting leaves on, then oaks. So that's also one of the reasons why they were favored. The last natural cavity nesting that I ever witnessed was probably just after the turn of the century. I'm trying to think of the year. Summer was around 2008, 2010. And that was over at Winona, Minnesota, overlooking the Mississippi River. I actually seen martens in at the end of July nesting in bur oaks. And that's the only place that I know of here in the Midwest.
Boy, that's amazing.
It is, and these birds are solely dependent on us for their housing. And so when you think about that, if we ignore the housing or ignore the birds along with it, that means that the birds can be subjected to other things. Predation is one. Certainly, that can affect them in many ways, by raccoons or mammalian type of predators, or the aerial in predators. And so if we ignore them, things can happen in those colonies because the birds are concentrated. And because they're concentrated, that means there's many voices being let out, and that's like ringing a dinner bell for those predators out there. And so you need to pay attention to what's going on. And purple martins are one of the first birds to arrive in Wisconsin from the neotropical birds coming from South America. Most people don't realize that. So when the end of March this year, roughly around the 25th, 26th, that's when our first purple martins entered the state. And quite often, they do not leave the state until really the first week in September. And much as I described where they concentrated down in Brazil, they also concentrate here in the state at a roosting site that's equally vulnerable, where you end up with about 30 to 90,000 purple martins gather in the month of August on about 6 acres. And so
wow.
you look at both ends and you kind of realize how small the world can be and how many human impacts can devastate this population out there.
Dick Nicolet, our guest today, retired biologist for the Wisconsin DNR, currently a Wisconsin Purple Martin Association board member. Questions for him about purple martins. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Oh, it's a nice song. Nice sound, the sound of the purple martin. And our guest knows that sound pretty well, Dick Nicolet, a retired biologist for the DNR, who is very interested in purple martins. Great to have him with us. Questions or comments for him? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Dick, I don't know if many people, I'm sure, have seen these houses. I certainly have seen many of them. But for those who haven't, what does a birdhouse for a purple martin look like?
Well, it can come in different phases now. It can look like gourds, which could be plastic or natural gourds out there itself. It could be made out of wood. Quite often, that's what most people have. And quite a few of the houses that people have out there are what I call the traditional old-style housing, which are small compartments of 6 inches by 6 inches by 6 inches. The newer compartments are generally 6 by 10 or 6 by 12 in wood or even aluminum. And they look like a home, a multi-story home. That's the best description that I can give, and with many holes in it.
You're right. Suzanne in Madison has a question about those homes. Let's go there. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. I was interested when you said the martins appear in late March because my spouse has one of those fake gourd contraptions that raises and lowers with, like, I don't know, 12 gourds. He's got it up at Lakeview County Park, and he always has to repeatedly take the house sparrow's nest out and put the, you know, so that the martins can get in there and nest. And it seems to me that if he had it up a little earlier, maybe the martins would get in there to nest before the house sparrows were in the mood to nest. That's my question.
Okay. Generally, the birds, the purple martins that arrive back from South America, are birds that have been established in those colonies. We are currently in a time period right now, beginning the first week in May through the end of June, is when the second-year birds, those are birds that were born last year in 2023, that are either going to arrive at those established colonies or looking for new sites. And so it's always of a benefit to keep housing closed until, if you have an established colony, until those first birds arrive. And the best description that I have to kind of control the problems that lots of people do, they get anxious and they open up all the holes, is that then you are subject to starlings and sparrows going in there and outcompeting those purple martins right away. But so you only will open up a handful of openings in the approximate time that for your area that they've returned. And so that's my suggestion for that. And as well as purple martins really cannot tolerate competitors in the housing. And so I always tell people, you only have purple martins in purple martin houses. Sparrows and starlings can easily kill adults, kill young, and toss out eggs, and your colony can be lost if you have an established one. If you don't, basically they keep or prevent you from getting purple martins in the first place.
Hmm. There you go, Suzanne. Thank you for calling. Tim in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Yes. I just returned, or I was down in Florida in March, riding a bike along the trail along by Orlando and so on. And they had purple martin houses there along the trail. Mm-hmm. And when I first started riding, there was no purple martins. And on the 15th of March, they start showing up, and, you know, you saw one or two, and then, they, you know, the whole crew shows up. Well, I leave Florida and come to La Crosse. I've had purple martin for 30 years, and mine have always showed up about the 15th of April, or at least the scout shows up around the 15th of April. And I just thought that was kind of unique. And I do trap sparrows. My family, it seems like it's terrible to be trapping sparrows, but I say the story, how'd you like to go to take the winter off and go to Florida and come back and find out that you have squatters in your house? And that's exactly what happened to the purple martins. And so I do trap them. People say, well, take them 20, 30 miles away. That doesn't work, and let them go. I always say, well, I'm not a chiropractor, but I know how to make neck adjustments.
Okay.
Well, it's very true that if you take a sparrow and deposit even 5 or 10 or 50 miles away, they likely will come back. And the next time you attempt to take care of that sparrow, it's going to avoid traps quite readily. And so it acts as a detriment to whomever it comes back to. So
there you go. Daniel in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. I have, every year I have the barn swallows come. They build the mud nests on the, they like a little ledge to build it on, and they seem to eat a lot of insects, but I've never had the purple martins. Are they the same family?
Well, they're aerial insectivores or belong in the swallow family, but they also feed at different heights, barn swallows versus purple martins or tree swallows or cliff swallows or ruffling swallows, all kind of have their own height that they like to feed for insects. And purple martins generally feed in the 200 to 400 feet above the landscape.
Interesting. Thanks, Daniel. Now, if you're setting out a purple martin, first place, where there are many places, I assume, you can get a purple martin house.
Yeah, there are, as well as there are locals within the state that actually build appropriate purple martin houses. All new houses should be able to be vertically lowered, and that means that you can be able to raise them either on a rope, Lennard, or some type of winch so that you can raise and lower the housing so that you can check the housing either on a daily basis or weekly or whatever set point in time to take care of the problems. The mistake that a lot of people make is, we had talked earlier, when they come back, people don't know that their birds are back if they leave the openings, and you end up with cool or colder weather. They could be dying in front of you without you knowing it, too. So that's the importance of constantly checking your housing to be able to know what's going on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Delmer and Endeavor, your turn. Hi.
Hi, I am Diane. I am Delmer's wife. My husband has hearing aids, and it's a little harder for him to hear on the phone. My husband has a big housing development for those martins. Last year, he lost two baby martins, and so he wanted to know if it was because it was so very hot and there was no circulation, or there's only the one hole, you know, that each compartment has. Is it okay to put some smaller holes so there is ventilation?
I didn't quite catch it. Is it okay to
put some smaller holes in for ventilation purposes?
Okay. It does help to have smaller holes in it, but you also have to remember and look back at temperatures that we have in May. If and we were approaching some of those bad temperatures, what I call bad temperatures, of 50s and going down into the 40s. Having more openings allows the cooler air in them, and depending on the type or make of housing that you have, aluminum houses hold the heat more, as well as to hold the cold more, and so it can be a little more detrimental for those birds by having more openings. The best that I can say is, if you want to put some openings because of the heat in the summer, have it so that you have like a plug so that you can pull the plugs out, the small little plugs or larger plugs. That way you get airflow, and you can always close them up if the weather turns colder. And like I said, within the last decade, we've had a lot, or at least here in northeastern Wisconsin, we've had a lot of weather that's been in May, June, and even into July, where it's been near 50 degrees for the whole day, and rainy and windy. All of those types of effects affect the birds.
Yeah. And here on that note, we are out of time. Dick, I want to thank you so much, and I invite people to take a look at the Wisconsin Purple Martin Association go on to their website because there's a lot of more information about those birds. Dick Nicolay, retired biologist with the DNR, current Wisconsin Purple Martin Association board member. Great to have him with us. And thank you for joining us here on WPR News Network. Our producers today, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors, as always, Lee Rayburn did a great job today. Jeff Robbins does as well. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.